Welcome to Advanced TV Herstory, where hearty discussion of all things TV draws a nifty circle around the women who have made it all happen. In each installment, we endeavor to celebrate, educate, illustrate, or analyze, all in the hopes of reaching listeners with the message that TV and women are very much a part of our lives. And it's okie dokie, it's fine and dandy that we talk about it, at length, in detail, with delight. So find this podcast along the great ones at Libsyn, Google Music, iTunes, and Auto Radio. Engage with us on Twitter. Our handle is at TV Herstory. I'm your host, Cynthia Bemis Abrams. I hope you enjoy this installment. Let's pick up on the great conversation I had with Dr. Elena Levine, professor of all things media at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. Listeners may remember Levine from the segment we did just a couple months ago on Agnes Nixon, who was the showrunner and daytime drama pioneer who passed away in 2016. Now, the professor and I discuss all her books in this segment. Seriously, how does she find time to watch TV? Including the one she's working on about daytime drama's place in American cultural history. We segue from that into her masterful account of how serialization, as opposed to episodic television, has evolved. American TV went from reluctantly inheriting the serial from radio, created soap operas, which I only call daytime dramas, and then gradually rebranded the form of storytelling to primetime with its own attendant starts and stops. Professor Levine tracks this evolution in context of women's roles, the storylines, and the people behind the scenes creating each hit or miss. I hope you enjoy this installment. Hey, Advanced TV Herstorians. Welcome to this segment of Advanced TV Herstory, where we are going to get down and detailed with a professor of graduate studies, media studies, journalism, advertising, and more media studies that influence women and gender and TV. We are going to be talking with Dr. Elena Levine of the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. And it's a beautiful, sunny, clear day here in Milwaukee. So welcome to Advanced TV Herstory.
Thank you.
Professor.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
But you undoubtedly did not just decide one day that you wanted to be a TV professor and a thinker and a writer. Tell us how it is that you developed your love of TV and particularly the women who have appeared on our screens.
Wow, great question. I've always really loved television, and as a child, my mother has this story about how as a, you know, infant, I was tearing pages out of TV Guide and trying to chew them.
Where'd you grow up?
I grew up in the Chicago suburbs.
All right.
And there, yes, so that, I had that, that's my mom's favorite story about my youth, but I really loved TV my whole life, and I really became, you know, really invested in television and film as a teenager, and thought, and also was really into writing. And thought I might want to be a TV writer.
And still could be.
I still could be. I'm going to hold out.
We might have to draft you.
Yeah. That. I went to college at, I went to Indiana University and was sort of torn because I was interested in media stuff, but I also really liked to write, which I associated with English and to read. And so I ended up being a double major in English and in what was called then telecommunications, which was basically where you go if you wanted to do TV related things. And so I did that double major. My telecom major started out being more production-oriented, and then I took some classes that were more kind of critical, historical, talking about television, and it blew my mind. I knew people talked about movies that way, but I didn't know people talked about TV that way, and I just fell in love, and I was like, this is awesome. This is the greatest stuff. This is what I want to do. But I thought I still might want to be a TV writer, and so after college, I've had thought that I might want to go to graduate school and study this professionally, but I also thought that I might want to still work in the industry. So I spent a few years, and I ended up working mostly in like corporate video production, corporate communications, public relations, those kinds of things, which was a good experience, but also showed me that I definitely wanted to go to graduate school and didn't want to stay in that world. So then I went to graduate school at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, because there were people there who were doing exactly what I was interested in. And it was really as a graduate student that I started to kind of really think about questions around gender and the place of women in television history. And my advisor had written this great book about Cagney and Lacey, and that really Julie Dachi, yeah.
Oh.
You know that book. It's a great book. Yeah, she just retired. And
that's a future segment of Advanced TV
History. Oh, totally. Yes. As a side note, I taught a piece, an article version of that book to my undergraduates this semester, and they loved it, and they didn't know what Cagney and Lacey was at all, and they were
criminal.
Yes.
Criminal.
They were fascinated. They were really into it. One of them told me, oh, I started going and looking up episodes and watching them, which was just amazing. Anyways,
do you know the reason why they had Sharon Glass wearing so much red and yellow?
I don't.
I'm going to have to start tweeting that question to her because Sharon Glass is on Twitter now.
Oh, awesome.
Yeah, but that's my question.
Yeah, that I don't know.
The fur coats are another story entirely.
Right.
All right, you got to teach a class on Cagney and Lacey, or a segment of it. Good for
you. Yeah, you know, we did one day where we talked about Cagney and Lacey. So anyways, so that was really, in graduate school, was where I really learned about this stuff and was introduced to this body of work of people writing about and studying both just television history in general and issues around women and both on screen and women audiences and the way the television industry thinks about women and all those kinds of things. And that just sort of sold me for life. And so I started to do that kind of research myself and, you know, am still here today doing more of that kind of thing.
Wow, that's excellent. Mm-hmm. And the kinds of classes that you teach here?
I teach a kind of combination of general kind of media studies, media history, theory, criticism kinds of classes, and sometimes more gender and media specific kinds of things. So, you know, sometimes I just teach general kind of introduction to media studies kinds of things, and you know, this semester I'm having a great experience teaching a gender and popular culture class to upper level undergraduates.
Cool. And would you say that in general, young women in particular are very mindful of the disproportionate representation of women on TV?
I think they are. I think that they don't know a lot about history, and they don't know a lot about where things have been over time and how things have changed and things like that. And so they're very in touch with contemporary
Lena
media
Dunham.
And know what's there, but they don't. They don't really have a sense of where that fits into like what's come before.
Mm-hmm.
So
in addition to your teaching, you have done some writing. Am I correct in that? And you have some stuff in the hopper.
Yes.
So tell us a little bit about what books are out there on the shelf that bear your name.
Okay.
And what we can expect in the short future.
Okay. So my first book was a revised version of my PhD dissertation, and that book is called Wallowing in Sex. And it's about the way in which the sexual revolution was handled on American television of the 1970s. So it looks at a wide range of different kinds of television, comedy, soap operas, action shows with women leads like Charlie's Angels and Wonder Woman, and talks about the ways in which made-for-TV movies is another thing I talk about. And it looks at the way that they were dealing with questions of sex at a time when the society itself was grappling with lots of change in terms of women's roles, in terms of greater visibility for gays and lesbians, and just in terms of general more openness.
Mm-hmm.
And so it tells the story of that period. And so that, you know, it's a project that I'm really proud of, and I spent many years on, and you know, think is a good read if people are interested.
And the name of it again is?
It's called Wallowing in Sex.
All right. It's published by
Duke University Press.
Thank you.
I've also edited a couple of books. I edited a book, co-edited a book with a colleague about the television series Buffy the Vampire Slayer. That was a really fun project. We wrote it. We edited it right at the time when the show was. It came out slightly a little after the show ended, but we were working on it certainly in the years where the show was really popular.
And what was the name of that one?
It's called Undead TV.
Hmm.
We started working on it when I was still a graduate student, and then early in my career, and it was a good experience in getting to know how to edit a book, but also to think in depth about a particular series and the many different ways in which people have talked about it.
Excellent.
It's a very, it's a show a lot of people like to talk about. Academics love to talk about Buffy. And so then, more recently, I just had a book come out last year that's an edited book as well. That's about, it's called Cupcakes, Pinterest, and Lady Porn, Feminized Popular Culture in the Early 21st Century. And it's a collection of essays that is focused on contemporary forms of popular culture that are kind of targeted to and consumed primarily by women or that are associated with women. This was something that I really was eager to see work on, new kinds of things like Pinterest, like scandal fans, like fashion blogging, mm-hmm. all these kinds of things that mm-hmm. seem to be really becoming the new kind of women's popular culture, but there wasn't a lot of scholarship on. Mm-hmm. And I felt like I couldn't study all of those things myself, so I decided to pull together this collection and find people who were working on them and have bring their contributions together. So that was a really fun project and one I enjoyed, you know, getting to talk about and teach since that came out.
And that was published by?
That was published by the University of Illinois Press.
Excellent.
I also have a book that I have co-authored called Legitimating Television, Media Convergence and Cultural Status. Mm-hmm. And that book is about the ways in which our ideas about television have changed in recent years, really mostly in the 21st century, and the way that television has achieved a new kind of cultural status, mm-hmm. Where a lot of people used to think of television as dumb and insignificant and not worth our time, and suddenly people started to take it seriously and talk about the great artistry that was going on there and how it was valuable and could be a site for lots of interesting artistic and creative efforts. And so the book is really looking at the way that that happened mm-hmm. and looking at some of the consequences of that and thinking about the ways that it actually still relies upon some assumptions about certain kinds of television as being still inferior and the ways that ideas about class status and gender play into those assumptions.
So. And that, ladies and gentlemen, listeners, friendly listeners, is what we are going to be getting into in this particular segment today. And also, you can expect in the future then to hear about yet another book. This is a busy, busy woman, and she also has a very cool office with, she's got the Bionic Woman, the Bionic Beauty Salon, I swear. It's, tears are coming down my eyes right now. Anyway, one more book in the hopper, this busy lady who teaches and thinks and writes, and that is?
I'm working on a book now called Her Stories, Daytime Soap Opera and U.S. Television History. And it's a history of the daytime television soap opera, starting at its origins and its transition from radio to TV in the 1950s and really carrying through to the present. It's a big, big project. I've been working on it for like 8 years. I mean, in some ways, I've been working on it my whole life, right, since I started watching soap operas when I was about 11 years old. But it is, you know, an in-depth project that explores lots of different things and that tries to grapple with this genre of TV that's, you know, very associated with women and also, I argue, you know, really central to the history of American television more generally, and that telling the story of this genre tells you a lot about the history of American television.
Well, wonderful. And we will talk about that more in the future, but I will only ask do you cover the fact that in the whole Luke and Laura thing from General Hospital, which I think was totally, totally normalized, we normalized a rapist and a woman marrying her rapist. Are you going to cover that?
Yeah. So in Wallowing in Sex, I actually have a chapter about rape stories on soap operas in the 1970s, including the Luke and Laura story. There were a lot of rape stories on soap operas in the 70s. Many of them, you know, really for the first time. There were a mm-hmm. few stories in the 60s.
Oh, Rita on Guiding Light.
Yes, I talk about Rita too. Very good. And Holly also. Roger raped Rita and then Holly. Yes.
Yeah. Lenore Kasdorf, if you're listening, please. AdvancedTVHerstory@gmail.com.
Yes. Yeah. I love that you know that. Part of me wanting to write this soap history book was writing that chapter was such a great experience and so fascinating about all these stories that came about in the time. And they really ranged widely in their attitudes and approach to mm-hmm. talking about rape. Mm-hmm. And of course, the Luke and Laura story is sort of infamous for being so, for kind of glossing over, you know, basically they have this story where he rapes her, and then over the next 9 months or so, and this is a lot of what I write about in that chapter, they have this like ongoing conversation and discussion about what happened and was it rape and was it not rape. And then they sends the characters kind of off on the run together about 9 months after the rape in the summer of 1990. 80. They go off on this big adventure, and that really starts the Luke and Laura phenomenon when they become this huge popular sensation. Yes. And then end up getting married in the fall of 1981. And the rape kind of gets completely, you know, buried. Yes. And never and, talked about again.
And for young listeners, you need to understand that college campuses around the country, this was must-see TV at 2 o'clock Central Time. And that 2 o'clock, yes. Yeah. That I did not watch because I was not a General Hospital watcher. Mm-hmm. But it was, this was water cooler talk. This was what was part of everyone's lives. Yeah. And how the media, how the writers and the producers of that show chose to navigate that storyline.
Yeah.
It was dicey.
Yeah, definitely. And I think what's most dicey is the way that it gets just dropped, and for a long, long time. There's actually, I'm just getting ready to write now about in the late 1990s, they revisited it, and the characters talked about it, and it became, you know, basically it was clear of, like, trying to take responsibility for this thing the show had done, you know, mm-hmm. almost 20 years previously, and what it all meant and what the ramifications were for the characters and their relationship, which is a really interesting, you know, kind of cultural moment, and showed, I think, how far things had come. But part of what happens, you know, in 1979 when Luke rapes Laura is that it's part of a much broader cultural moment where you're seeing that kind of really romanticized picture of rape happening in lots of places. It was mm-hmm. happening in romance novels. Mm-hmm. It was happening on other soap operas. It was happening, you know, in various places across our culture. And the fact that we, you know, that seems so inconceivable to us now is really telling right. of the way attitudes change over time.
And we'll pause. We're going to make one. I need to make one more point on this, in particular the context of it, because really what we find is, you know, and I think it was Bernie Rosenzweig talking about Charlie's Angels and Cagney and Lacey that really has reminded me that those were very incremental, hard-fought steps every yeah. step of the way. So the viewing audience in 1978, 79 was everybody from 12 years old. I mean, I was 13 when I was watching Ryan's Hope mm-hmm. to 70-year-olds, my mm-hmm. grandma. Mm-hmm. And so they really walked a fine line that could not be too, I mean, there's no question that it could have been more progressive, but on the other hand, this was still, they still had to play to their viewers right. and to be, I guess it would be fascinating to hear some of these writers in retrospect, but still it was the day and it was the moment. And you could say, well, at least they were talking about rape.
Right. Right. And that's actually part of my
small consolation, but it's huge in the greater context.
Right. That's part of my argument, is that the soaps were one place where this issue, which was getting increasing just public discourse in general in the 70s, because mm-hmm. there was all this anti-rape activism that was basically pushing the idea that rape is violence mm-hmm. And that it's not romanticized. This was happening in that moment, and people were hearing about this, and the soaps were really exploring what all that meant mm-hmm. across a range of different stories, some of which were much more aligned with kind of anti-rape activism than others. Mm-hmm. And I think while there's lots of problematic things about the Luke and Laura story, part of what happens in the sort of 9-month period between the rape and when they go off on the run together and sort of become a couple is that they kind of discuss and debate what rape means and whether this was rape, and is rape something that is an act of love or is an act of, you know, hate. And you would only know this if you went back, as I did, and watched all these scenes and saw this. And it's, you know, I don't want to excuse it, because I think it's still quite problematic. But at the same time, if you try and really put yourself in the mind of what it meant to live in that time and to just be kind of confused. I mean, I'm sure people who were the victims of rape were not confused. They suffered. Right. And there's no doubt that they suffered. And yet, at the same time, I think as a general public issue, people were really trying to figure out what it was all about, because no one was talking about it
right.
before that
right.
point.
Well, I mean, so in 1980, I was still in high school,
mm-hmm.
but I felt that it was unseemly that this was unfolding, and that it then unfolded for 5 straight years. You know, uh-huh. that this was kind of the capstone story. This was the lead couple, the big arc for all of General Hospital for
right.
so long.
Yeah.
And it was, there was this unstated beginning to their history. Yeah. And but, you know, that was for somebody then who was in their teens and their early 20s, whereas somebody who was in their 40s watching it from home every single day,
yeah,
maybe looked at it differently. So, yeah. All right. Well, that was a road we just had to walk down.
Yes, absolutely.
Let's talk a little bit more about serialization and how you talk about that as an aspect of legitimating television and really where we've come from those the radio days to TV, it being a much more female-oriented audience. And really, when you talk about serialization for the purposes of the work, the research that you do and did in the writing, mm-hmm. define how you connect serialization to what we think of as soap operas to now what is being explored through certainly HBO and Showtime and all of the premium channels, but also what we are now seeing on TV, you know, on broadcast TV. And where do, and then I'll just throw in one more, where do miniseries fit in? Mm-hmm. And where does Joan Collins and her awesome shoulder pads fit in? Because I guess you could lose an episode or two of Dynasty and really lose nothing in the process.
Yeah.
They weren't maybe quite as continuous in the plot development. So help us understand serialization so that we can get all of this figured out as we're listening.
Mm-hmm. So serialization has a long history in broadcast history and in television, but also, as you say, radio
history. People love
their
stories.
Mm-hmm. Yes, people love their stories. But initially, certainly, I mean, we have to go back to radio, I think, a little bit here to talk about this. You know, at the very early days, there was uncertainty about what kinds of stories to tell in initially radio and then even in TV, and whether people would follow along. And there were a number of different genres of television that told continuing stories, which is what we mean by serialization, that the stories continue from episode to episode.
Even though it's soap operas, you could kind of miss a week and not miss a whole lot.
Oh, for sure.
Because it was so slow moving.
For sure.
Yeah.
Okay. And so initially this was going on in various genres and various different parts of the day on radio. And then gradually it really got focused into daytime and into the radio programs that became known as soap operas. And, you know, as you say, the stories would continue, but it doesn't mean that, like, every episode was a crucial component of the story. There was a lot of time spent repeating and going over things and moving quite slowly. There were also only 15 minutes a day initially on radio, so a lot of that was commercial time. So there was not a whole lot of story that was getting told per episode. So in the transition to television, there's those logics about the serial narrative, the continuing story being kind of isolated in daytime that was eventually settled on in radio kind of carries over. And that starts to be the logic for television, too. And initially, there was a lot of uncertainty about whether that kind of programming would even work on television because they didn't think that women would stop in the middle of the day and watch TV, you know, in the middle of the day and stop their housework, whereas they could listen to the radio and still be, you know, dusting or doing whatever housework they were supposed to be doing. And so, but eventually that works itself out, and television, serialized storytelling in the form of daytime soap opera continues into television. And it really is not, most of primetime television is pretty what we call episodic at that point, meaning the stories would be contained in a single episode. You could watch them in any order, you could pick them up at any time, and it didn't really matter. And then starting in the 1960s, there starts to be some experimentation with telling continuing stories in primetime as well as in daytime, because daytime soap operas were pretty successful. The TV industry was paying attention to that. And so, you know, there was the kind of famous example of Peyton Place, which had been this, you know, hugely successful, that would be a cool subject for you, hugely successful novel that then got made into a television series.
After the two trashy films.
Yes, right. It has a long, long media history.
Watched it during a blizzard.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. Yep, it had been feature Hollywood Films and then got made into an evening, continuing, serialized television series. I think initially it was on three or four nights a week.
Wow.
Yeah. And then they scaled back to two nights, but it was never just a single night a week. It was on at least two nights a week during its run. was very popular at first, and this sent all, you know, the TV business, which loves to chase a hit, right? Mm-hmm. Whatever works, they want to do the next thing, sent this frenzy going and trying to start thinking about doing these continuing stories in primetime TV, you know, basically soap operas, although they didn't want to talk about them in those terms because that was so disparaged and associated with women and daytime and commercialism. So there's this moment in the 60s where there was this kind of experiment with it. It sort of dies out. None of the imitators of Peyton Place are nearly as successful as Peyton Place. And then serialization tends to go back into daytime and stay there. But in the 1970s, you asked about miniseries. And the American television business starts to program miniseries in the 70s, initially borrowing them from Britain, and then starting to do their own. And these were, you know, miniature versions of continuing narratives, where soap operas would go on for years and years and decades. These would be, you know, 13 episodes, 20 episodes, you know, a limited number of episodes, and would tell a story, you know, that continued across those episodes. And those were hugely successful in the 70s on American TV, primetime TV. And I think that that helped to encourage more continuing series that also told serialized narratives. So Dallas starts in the late 1970s. Dallas has a really interesting history, too, because it's not initially serialized. It's quite episodic at first, and they were very concerned that people would not want to watch. Of course, keep in mind here, this is even pre-VCRs, right? This is people having to be there to turn on their TV and watch the episode week to week. And so there was some concern about that, and Dallas gradually gets more serialized over its, like, first three seasons up to, like, the Who Shot JR moment and becomes a huge, huge hit. And so with that, then there's this explosion in what were called primetime soap operas. The Dallas, The Dynasty, Knott's Landing, Falcon Crest, all their imitators, which were, you know, a big sensation for most of the 80s. But by the later 80s, as tends to happen in TV, their ratings start to decline and the industry moves away from it. But at the same time in the 80s, there was a sort of different kind of television that was starting to tell continuing stories. And those were these kind of unusual dramas that were different than what we'd seen on TV before. Shows like Hill Street Blues and St. Elsewhere and things like that, which were had some episodic elements, but started to tell more continuing stories in a way that was, you know, very overtly and deliberately borrowing from things like soap opera to continue narratives from episode to episode. And those shows got a lot of attention. They were seen as very impressive. They were understood as a kind of bringing a kind of quality to television that people didn't think they'd seen before. And that tradition, I think, is really where we see a lot of the contemporary shows that get a lot of attention and that tell those serialized stories from the HBO shows, the, you know, even basic cable, and of course, you know, broadcast network shows too do this now, where continuing stories becomes the kind of coin of the realm and the thing that people want to tell and see. But of course, it's much easier for people to follow those now because we have so many ways of accessing content that we... It's no problem. You're not committed to a particular day and time to be able to follow a narrative. You can follow it in lots of different ways. So that's so
that
real
gets
sweeping
us
terms.
To our the examples that you cited in the book, though, and why we're talking about this in the context of women is that when we think about what these modern serialized shows are, and if you want to list a few, we can also do the Bechdel test then and come up with how many women, God bless Edie Falco, I guess, but how many women really are considered primary characters or even significant supporting characters.
Right. Yeah, part of the argument we make in legitimating television is that a lot of the contemporary examples of this kind of so-called quality serialized drama on television are very... go to kind of deliberate pains to distinguish themselves from the more soap opera-like tradition that they are, you know, they would seemingly be connected to. They really are very focused on achieving their status and their reputation as quality by associating themselves with men and by rejecting their connection to soap opera. And part of their association with men is that the main characters tend to be men. Women characters have very little place in a lot of these shows. So, you know, The Sopranos is probably the kind of big kind of initial example that set off this more recent wave of especially cable serialized dramas that received a lot of acclaim. But there's many that followed in their wake. You know, Breaking Bad isn't a good example of this. The Shield, which was the one, was the first of these kind of basic cable dramas to take on this more continuing narrative style. And
Game of Thrones,
House of Cards. More contemporary examples like House of Cards and Game of Thrones. Of course, there are women characters in these shows, but they are tend to be centrally concerned with male and often like anti-hero characters, sort of male characters that are morally compromised in various ways, and that seem to be kind of intriguing to audiences for the ways that they walk this line. I mean, even, you know, we could talk about Mad Men in these terms, too. And so there's all of these shows that tell these stories about male characters, but that's one way in which I think that they try to separate themselves and achieve their status and their distinction. But there's other ways, too. They tend to focus on more kind of masculinized realms of activity. So the mafia world of The Sopranos, or they're not as focused on interpersonal drama, family relationships, sure, those kinds of things that, of course, are the hallmarks of daytime soap opera. And so that distinction, that move away from those kinds of things, is another way in which I think that they tend to reject and push aside questions about femininity, women, and their concerns.
Wow. So really, the test became, if it looked good in the man cave, to be showing on the TV in the man cave, it was it probably had a better chance of being a hit. That's why we don't see these as being set in law firms and, you know, and Ewing Oil and places like that, but really rather sort of the seedy side of the American male experience of the 2000s and 2010. And then we wonder why we have what we have today.
Yeah. You know, I should say, I think that some of those shows are pretty critical of these kind of masculine realms, and like they look, you know, they're trying to kind of look at the problems with this kind of violent masculinity or, you know, hostile masculinity. I mean, I think that there are different shows to different degrees are engaged with those questions, and I think that those are important concerns for women and for feminism to think about masculinity and the problems with male roles and expectations for men, too. But the kind of overwhelming sense in which the main characters are men, the things that are valued and praised about these shows tend to deal with the male creators and the male actors and the male concerns and settings. Those kinds of things, kind of in the big picture, I think, are not so good for women. And again, I mean, I think looking closely at these narratives, you might see more going on than just these, you know, oh, that's a male world, than just that. But in the big picture, I think it's kind of speaks in pretty concerning ways about how women and things associated with femininity are valued versus men and masculinity.
So then with regard to serialized shows that feature women as strong leads in the last 5 years, it's a short list.
Yeah.
But it is there.
Oh,
sort
absolutely.
Of. So what are some of those that we, if particularly if people aren't paying a lot of attention or don't spend a lot of time kind of trolling the outer limits of their cable channels, what's out there that we've all missed?
Yeah, oh, I don't know what you've missed. I mean, maybe you have some ideas of things that I'm missing. I mean, I think that the Shonda Rhimes shows, which no one's missed, like everybody's aware of those shows, like are an interesting space where you get, you know, women in much more prominent roles and women's concerns get more attention, and those are serialized narratives, and they are, I think, a lot more willing to embrace their connection to soap opera and to the world of, you know, feminized concerns. They're also not as kind of highly valued and respected in our culture at large. They're not winning the Emmys most of the time. They're not getting a lot of the critical praise. And I think there's, you know, there's something to be said about that.
It is saving grace with Holly Hunter.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, I don't know that show that well, but there's definitely these examples, you know, well, there's, and there's also comedies, too. I think comedies don't get as much attention often as dramas, but like Nurse Jackie as a premium cable comedy, Veep, Julie Louis-Dreyfus's show Veep. Mm-hmm. So there's some of those comedy spaces where I think you get this kind of thing. And there's, you know, there's shows like The Closer that was on for, yes, you know, a long, yes, long time. Yes. And, you know, it was a more episodic show. It had, mm-hmm, some serialized elements, mm-hmm, but a little bit more of an episodic show. But certainly, mm-hmm, the character of Brenda is an important character, you know, historically for, huge, television representations of, mm-hmm, women. You know, I'd have to, like, yeah, download. There's so much content now. Right. You know, television has exploded in terms of the number of outlets. I mean, yep, people talk about a show like Orange is the New Black, which seems to have, you know, faltered a little bit maybe in recent years, but that is a show that is almost exclusively focused on women, sure, characters and their concerns.
Though we could take a little slide off the interstate here for a second, mm-hmm, and ask the other probing question, which is, why are most of these serialized quality shows, or even why is so much of this only landing on premium cable?
I mean, in some ways, this is the premium cable brand and now the streaming brand, mm-hmm, in, mm-hmm, a lot of senses, that, mm-hmm, they've chosen to, or it's, you know, basically, I think they tried it out and it worked, mm-hmm, right? So they, mm-hmm, tried HBO tried The Sopranos and it worked. And so it stuck with that identity. You know, now Netflix, House of Cards was their first, mm-hmm, you know, original streaming series. It worked. They're sticking with this identity, mm-hmm, that I think, you know, the TV business, even in premium cable, even in streaming, even in these things that don't seem to be guided by the same commercial forces as television has historically been because they don't have advertising, it really has worked the same, like, throughout its history in terms of, like, imitation and figuring out what works and sticking with it as a way to try and hold on to audiences. You know, for premium cable and streaming, that's for subscription audiences, mm-hmm, whereas, you know, basic cable broadcast, it's more about getting advertiser, you know, getting the ratings so that advertisers are willing to pay higher rates for ad spots. But those concerns are, you know, you can't ever forget that these things are a business and that they're trying to attract customers. And I think part of the way to attract customers is to have an identifiable brand, and that's become the brand for a lot of these premium services. And again, part of the legitimating television argument is that is dependent upon the kind of elitist, in some ways, associations of those shows and their kind of masculine associations, that is part of what gets them the kind of credibility and the status.
Hmm. Wow. There's a lot there. There's a lot there. And also the fact that every year more households are cutting the cord.
Yeah.
And every year, streaming isn't just something that people under 25 do because they've always got their laptops with them. Now, right, everybody's doing it to, right, some degree on their phone or their tablet, wherever they might be. So that is now, and it's also becoming a more affordable way to deliver entertainment, even to somebody who just doesn't really want to have a full package or be very selective in what they're seeing.
Mm-hmm.
So for those who are trying to make the decisions on the back end as well, I think we as women need to be as vocal as ever before, mm-hmm, about the fact that we aren't just complacent and willing to accept whatever is put out there wherever we receive it. What kind of advice would you give, a call to action, for a listener of this podcast to ensure that we're seeing representation at all of those different levels? How do we do that?
That's a really good question. I'm not sure. I wish I had the golden answer there, but it seems like the, you know, I think we tend to forget that our, you know, consumer choices, you know, end up having these kinds of powers. And I think what happens is that people cut the cord, subscribe to these streaming services, and sort of take what they're given on them. And, mm-hmm, it's convenient and it's easy and it's, you know, fun and all that kind of thing. But that what, especially like a Netflix, offers is quite limited, both in terms of the new content, but also its its historical archive, like what it's offering you of TV history.
Which is getting to be less and less every month.
Yes, is tightening, and we take that as like, that's just what it is. It actually reminds me quite a bit of the sort of classic network era where people, you had three channels and you turned on the TV and you watch what was on.
Yep.
That's sort of what Netflix is now for many people. You turn it on, you watch whatever's there.
When it comes to be that the only option is Hogan's Heroes, we know we know that hell is near.
And so, yeah, I mean, I think, you know, kind of seeking out those moments that do happen where there is something that is more, that you feel like speaks more to your concerns as a woman or that addresses women's issues in a way that is, you know, compelling to you. I think that, you know, supporting those kinds of programs wherever they appear, watching them, being vocal about them publicly, social media, that kind of thing, those kinds of things, you know, are probably the best we can do as consumers to advocate for the things that interest us. They're in the minority in a lot of ways. And I think increasingly, like, we have to, the culture as a whole needs to tell more stories about a wider array of women. That's always been the problem and the case.
Yes.
But I think more and more so, like, women need to kind of, through our entertainment, through our fictional narratives, find ways to kind of understand and empathize with the experiences of women who are different from ourselves. And the more we can do that, I think the better for us all. Television historically has not done a great job of giving us that really wide array of women and, you know, grasp onto those. And if the storytelling is compelling, people will be there usually. So hopefully that will happen.
So there's that crappy adage that you hear at every conference just when they're about to either announce that, like, your unit's been about to be laid off or they're going to take some big change in the company and nobody asked you. But, that adage that if you always do what you've always done, then you'll always get what you've always gotten. And we can either bemoan the sad state of programming and the horrendous representation that is currently even in our media and on our TVs today, 2016, or we can say, no, we have to do something else. And we all have voices and we all have phones and we all have Twitter accounts and Facebook pages. We now need to get more vocal. And we shouldn't be cowering in as our excuse, because somehow someone's going to pick on us or call us a name or start to troll us or hunt us because we have told Netflix that we really, really like Lily Tomlin and Jane Fonda, and that is quality, that is clever, that is smart TV, and we want to see more of it. No one is going to hunt you down for saying that you like something.
Right.
Provide the feedback, provide your demographics of who you are, how long you've been watching, and what other sorts of things you watch and do. That is the kind of data that thus far, as long as somebody's making decisions saying we don't get that data, as long as there's some man saying that we don't have to merchandise Rey from Star Wars in 2015 because boys won't play with girl figurines, then some man is going to project himself to be the smartest person in the room.
Yeah.
There is no data. So we need to provide that data, and we need to get it into the hands of the social media coordinators at all of those companies, at all of those production houses, at all of the broadcast networks, the premium networks, everybody.
Yeah.
That's our call to action to ensure that whether it's serialization or just overall representation, that we are looking at a better tomorrow than we've been living with.
Yeah.
And we just can't. We can celebrate the great work of the past. We can celebrate the diligence. But we also have to take advantage of the fact that we have this knowledge and we have the keys to make it better.
Yeah, for
sure. How's that for
a
pep talk?
That's a call to action.
I love
it.
A sermon.
Yeah, go.
Well, Elena, you get the point, I think, for being the only interview guest who has used the phrase coin of the realm. So clearly an educated woman here. And we look forward to having yet another podcast segment to talk about other cool things. But this has been tremendous. And your book, actually, we were going to talk about showrunners and we were going to talk about a lot of other things. But most importantly, the serialization thing is thought-provoking, and it really requires, I mean, wow, I usually put out a one-hour podcast, you know, sometimes a one-hour podcast. We've been talking. You've really laid out this entire stream of how TV has evolved over time through serialization and how it is that we get to the end of it all, and we've had incredible this incredible run at daytime, which is so undervalued. And now here we are sitting with serialization being within the total economics of premium cable, and even that, which is then there, is so male-dominated. Everybody just take a moment, think about it some, and if you've got any thoughts or ideas about what Elena's been saying, shoot us a message, advancedtvherstory@gmail.com, or on Twitter at TVHerstory. And Elena, how can people get a hold of you?
I'm happy to get emails from folks. My email is ehlevine, L-E-V-I-N-E, at uwm.edu. And I'm also on Twitter. My handle is at EHL, and I'm happy to hear from you.
Cool. Well, this has been fantastic. I'm always happy when we can at least talk a little bit about soap operas. And, wow, Guiding Light, Ryan's Hope. And that's why we're here, Advanced TV Herstory. Thanks for listening. Thank you, Elena, for your time and your knowledge. There's just so much.